Hello, and thank you for joining us on this episode of The Dev Team. I'm Mark Onsman.
I'm Daryl Kilzer.
And I'm Jake Overall.
We're a group of developers and bootcamp instructors here to help you in joining the world as a software developer. Whether you're a self-taught developer, bootcamp grad, or a CS student, we're here to help you fill in some of the knowledge you need to grow in your role as a junior developer.
On this episode, Mark starts us off by spiraling into recursion. Then we take flight with Boeing's security updates. Lastly, we wrap up with Daryl's tips on contributing to open source projects.
So I'm going to start us off with the word of the day, and I kind of was looking at a couple different things, and I actually wanted to talk about recursion today.
What was that?
Recursion.
One more time, please.
Oh, I see what you're doing. So recursion... Recursion is essentially when a function calls itself, and it's nothing really much more complex than that, but we see it used in a lot of different places, and probably the place I see it the most is when I'm talking or working with someone with a CS degree, and like maybe they're trying to solve like a simple problem like Fibonacci sequence or something of that nature, right? And oftentimes, what they'll do is they'll write some bit of code that solves the first part of the problem and then just invoke the function inside of it, and it kind of creates a spiraling recursion function calling itself. However, I think most of the time, and maybe you guys can answer when you've seen it, my opinion is most of the time when I see this, it's used inappropriately. I find that in that exact situation, for example, a for loop just as easily solves the problem, and you're adding a layer of complexity that's not needed.
Yeah, I would agree with you that the bulk of the time that I see recursion is, you know, often in like whiteboard challenges or specifically in those like, you know, Edabit type style websites where, hey, I'm going to, you know, try and solve this complex problem. And it specifically calls out, try and use recursion, right? And I think recursion is, you know, it's definitely an approach to solving a problem. And sometimes I would even argue that recursion may even be easier to read for a developer. But actually understanding how it works, I think, you know, if you look at the call stack and some of the things that are the bad features of recursion, I would say, yeah, a lot of times it's very inappropriately used. And if you throw it into your actual application, you probably shouldn't, right? A while loop is 100% going to be a lot more performant than something like recursion.
Yeah, I think I would have to agree on those points for sure. I think the best use case I've seen for it, or the most common one, is you get that challenge, try to solve this without a for loop. And they go into the, you know, I'm using recursion, so technically...
Let me give you handcuffs in a situation that we'll never actually experience in the real world.
Yeah. And I think that's the more common thing that I've seen personally.
Now, I will point out specifically that there are languages that are better suited for recursion, right? You know, talking specifically about like tail-end recursion, you know, take a language like C# that's, you know, compiled. And I think the compile step is very important when dealing with recursion, because a lot of the times during the compile step, you know, things get boiled down into a more performant style of code anyways. And you're going to not suffer from the performance drain that you would in, you know, say, throw recursion into a language like JavaScript, and what are you doing? Absolutely, under no circumstance should you be using recursion in a production worthy application in a language like JavaScript.
To me, and I think the other piece to call out there is even specifically what's happening and why it's dangerous, not just performant, but it's everyone's favorite website. Recursion is actually oftentimes what causes a Stack Overflow. And I'm not just talking about looking up on Stack Overflow. I'm talking about the actual Stack Overflow, because every time you call that function, it's essentially adding to the stack another active function call and all the variables that exist. And that now lives currently in the memory stack. And that stack grows and grows and grows, and eventually you end up with that Stack Overflow.
That's funny. I've never actually considered the fact that there may be developers out there that don't understand that Stack Overflow is an actual like exception type or an error type. So that's hilarious. I've never actually considered that.
Yeah, it's also what happens when a developer eats too many pancakes.
Ooh, I love pancakes.
Oh, is that what their icon is?
But lastly, I just want to kind of touch onto this. And if you're entering into a whiteboard challenge or you're finding yourself in that boat that they say, oh, you know, maybe you should use recursion. I would totally be brave in that moment and say, hey, you know what? Here's why I didn't. Because I think, again, maybe many developers don't really think about that and say, oh, well, this is a cool thing. And I feel like that's a whole nother conversation entirely. But so many times we find something that's cool, but it's not the best way to handle things. And again, this gets into like time complexity and memory complexity and, you know, a much bigger topic, but something to think about when you're really diving into those.
Yeah, I wouldn't say you should avoid learning recursion by any sense of the imagination. It's a unique way to look at problems and to solve problems. And I think it's definitely worth your time to investigate and learn. But if you're putting it into production applications, you probably shouldn't. Look for a more performant way to solve problems.
Yeah, I think that readability comes into play for those whiteboard challenges. It can be easier to see the context directly just calling that recursion there.
Cool. That's it for me. What do you got for us, Jake?
Yeah. So talking about the news this week, this is actually an article I ran across just the other day. Would you believe it if I told you that all of Boeing's 747s, in order to receive updates, they actually run off of a 3.5-inch floppy drive in order to update Boeing 747s?
Ouch. That's, wow.
Right.
That's reassuring.
So I was shocked, of course, to like hear the title and like look at that. And as I actually read the title, it makes a lot of sense, though. Take something like an airplane that's carrying a bunch of people. What you don't want is potential attack vectors. And if I'm in an airplane and I need regular updates, how dangerous is it if I'm using updates just over the web or something of that nature, right? Like talking about like security from a completely different perspective, right? And something that I would have just like, this is antiquated technology. Why in the heck are we doing it this way? A lot of the times, yes, there's an actual reason behind. And in this instance, it's something like security, which I think is a really kind of interesting thing to just kind of point out. And I think sometimes as you come into like a new job or you come into a new environment, it's really easy to fall into that mistake of like, well, why the heck are they doing it this way? And to think instantly that you have a better idea. And I think that's a really common mistake that a lot of people fall into.
Where I kind of look at that is they found a hardware solution to a software problem. And I was reading an article the other day or something. It was talking about, and of course, I think everyone knows this, that the biggest flaw in any system is the human factor, right? And so I'm wondering, though, that hardware solution certainly prevents the super hacker in a way. And of course, I say that super hacker, which obviously I'm sure you know, nothing is unhackable. But I don't know. I guess, you know, what's to say that I couldn't easily just swap that floppy? Did it talk about like what security measures they have in place?
Yeah. So the interesting thing there is like protocols, right? There's a lot of different protocols that are actually in place. One of those things is like the plane actually must be grounded, right? And some of the other things that are kind of interesting is the floppy drives that are actually stored on the airplanes, there's behind like a dual key system. And only so many different people have the keys to those different lockboxes. And, you know, so it's fascinating, right? And I won't pretend to be an expert in this because, you know, I read a blog post, right? But I think it just gives a little bit of insight into, you know, this is a very real world problem that could have catastrophic effects if, you know, hacking does occur, right? And that social engineering piece, I'm sure, is definitely a part of this as well. But it's one of those things that, you know, there's at least a protocol in place and there's a reason for, you know, this antiquated technology to still be there. And until we have a better solution, let's not break what essentially hasn't been hacked yet.
Yeah, a little bit of the security through obscurity in that play right there. That's kind of interesting. I would have never thought about that. I'm curious how many disks they actually have stored, you know, thinking back to some of those old games, insert disk 22, you know.
Yeah. Imagine something like Google Maps, like disk 3,746.
That's just crazy to think about. So I'd be interested to know, you know, how many disks do they have?
Which does kind of bring up, like, why not use a USB or something that has larger memory format to it? And maybe that's because it is more prone to the possibility of, hey, there's extra space on here. I'm going to slip a little extra code.
Right. Well, I think that comes to the easeability of, like, plug and play. You know, just simply inserting a USB drive into most modern computers, you know, there's software that you can get to run automatically based upon the insertion of a USB thumbstick. Right. And so that's actually incredibly dangerous to say, hey, let's switch out for USB drives. No, absolutely under no circumstance should we, because some random person's going to pick up a USB drive in the parking lot, you know, common attack vector, actually, and plug it into their computer or plug it into one of these airplanes. And now all of a sudden that airplane is compromised. And that's, you know, incredibly dangerous.
Absolutely. I think that's been one of the bigger, more common attack vectors that pretty much every large corporation has suffered. Even, oh, I have this kiosk on my network, and it accepts a USB, just plug that in, and now someone has access to the entire network. So
yeah, USB drives from a security professional standpoint, very, very dangerous tool. And key drops are specifically a thing. I participated in, some of these types of studies and whatnot, but, we just took 100 random USB sticks because, they cost a dime a dozen and went and just dropped them in random parking lots to figure out, who's randomly plugging in USB drives. Don't do that.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of, those little security things that are just, security is just a massive thing. And so it's interesting to see a company's approach to the problem of exactly that. How do I prevent somebody from doing that? Now, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go get my pilot's license, and Daryl gave me the idea here. I'm going to plug Doom into the new Boeing, and we're going to play Doom while we pilot. And so you guys want to come multiplayer with me in the cockpit?
Yeah, no thanks. I'm not going to join that.
I trust the autopilot. I think we'll be fine.
Yeah. Hopefully it doesn't get taken over by any of the AI in Doom.
No, that's true.
That's probably not good. All right, Daryl, why don't you go ahead and bring us on with the deep dive today?
All right, so I kind of wanted to talk about some of the benefits and reasons for why I enjoy contributing to open source projects and why I think new developers should consider contributing to an open source project. So I got a couple different points I can go off of here, but I want to start by going back quite a long time ago for me in my career anyways, back to when I was younger and I worked in a little bit different sector of the tech field. I was specifically a Linux specialist, and to be even more specific, networking. That was kind of my big thing. I had a whole basement full of servers. And so one of the things that kind of made me especially valuable to the companies I worked for was just that passion and that knowledge by contributing to the Linux kernels and some of the modules for those. And so through that, I got this kind of intimate knowledge with exactly how it works and kind of all the stuff under the hood. And so I don't know if you guys have kind of done anything like that or not, or if you contribute to open source.
Yeah, I think contributing to open source is an excellent idea. It's definitely one of those things that I think can be very intimidating as well. And with today's world, I'm sure it's a lot easier now to contribute to open source projects, with everything on GitHub and whatnot, than it was to contribute to Linux kernels back in the day. And so I think one of the common questions, right, or one of the common hurdles or roadblocks, so to speak, for trying to contribute to an open source project is first and foremost, what project should I contribute to and how do I find one that's open to contributors? Any tips on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that kind of wraps up the end of kind of my intro there. It's anything that you're actively working with, like the tools and the software that you're actively working with wherever you work. If you can go and find maybe a feature that isn't there, that needs to be there, or that you think should be there, that would be useful. And then going to kind of their GitHub or something like that, they'll generally have a little section there that says, hey, first-time contributors, here's your chance, here's your spot. These are issues that are a little bit easier to tackle, a little more friendly, and it gets you used to kind of the guidelines and things of what they're going to expect as far as CI and CD or testing or anything of that nature, or the format of what they want you to produce to actually be able to contribute and get your pull request accepted.
For me, I think to add into that, I'm going to build off what Jake said, holy imposter syndrome, right? I think that's probably the biggest hurdle right there. And being able to identify ones that they say, hey, this is good or this is bad, or this is, this is one that is an easy one to fix, right? Sometimes you'll see those in the bug logs and whatever the case may be. If nothing else, and this is somewhat of a joke, but it's oftentimes used to contribute, go through the readmes. And if you're particularly good at, hey, this documentation is really unclear, maybe you could be the one to help resolve some of that clarity in documentation. Hey, I had to figure this out because, holy cow, these docs are no good. Submit that pull request with just clarity in the documentation.
Yeah, and to go along just specifically with that, build an example, right? I can't tell you how many open source libraries I've used, and there's very, very few, if any, examples on how to use the library, right? And sometimes it's really nice to just be able to look at a sample code. So if you've done nothing more than build something with that tool to show off how it works, go ahead and throw that into a folder called examples. And I know most libraries,
you know, will accept an examples folder as well, right? And of course, you should adhere to their guidelines and their recommendations. And a lot of them have, you know, if you want to submit a pull request, this is how you do it and follow this format. And code standards are a thing and linters are a thing. And, you know, there's a lot to learn there, but I think there's so much potential for learning that diving into an open source project is definitely worth the effort to try and figure out, you know, what it is you want to do.
I think to build on that just right there is the other thing is you now get to see how other people code and in a good, bad, and in between, right? Sometimes you fall into this rut of, well, this is how I do it. And this is, I write this and then I do this and I write this and this is how my linter is set up. And, you know, this is the right way, but maybe just even exploring a little bit into open source and saying, okay, well, how are they doing it? And we've talked several times about that code ninja idea. You very much, when you're contributing to open source, want to be a code ninja. And so you have to be able to quickly look at the code that they've written and identify where and what you need to do to blend in with that code.
Yeah, that's crucially important. You know, a lot of us have our IDEs and we have our settings and configurations, you know, tabs versus spaces, the old age-old argument, right? And I remember I submitted a pull request and I only really changed like two or three lines of code to resolve a real problem. And my linter or my IDE has converted all of the tabs to spaces. And so when I submitted a pull request, it was like, there's been 643 lines of code changed. And I'm like, wait a second, let me close that pull request and, you know, go and fix my own IDE settings and then resubmit it. And I think that's also very important to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you guys added on to two of the big points here is, you know, the open source community is vast. Like there's a ton of people. You're getting all kinds of value from exposure to developers outside of your normal work habit, right? They're going to do things a little differently. They're going to have different ideas. And so that's awesome in and of itself. And then also kind of just to touch back on what you'd said earlier, Mark, it can be pretty scary trying to get into that, but that's kind of what that newbie section is for, is this community is very, very welcoming, generally speaking. And even if you make those pull requests, changing the tabs over, you're usually going to get a friendly response of, hey, I would love to accept this. Your code looks great, but could you convert that back to tabs and not spaces, please?
Yeah, and I've even seen where sometimes, you know, they'll be like, oh, yeah, the excellent fix. I'm going to deny your pull request, and then I'll actually just go write the code because you didn't know how to adhere to our standards. And then you don't actually get kind of the credit for that fix, which is unfortunate, right? But I think that's where it's very, very crucially important for you to look at those guidelines, look at those recommendations, and then, you know, make sure that you're adhering to those, right? I think the other thing that you also want to particularly look at is many of these open source projects will have like an active Gitter, or they'll have an active Slack channel or Discord or something of that nature. If you want to contribute, you know, jump in there, talk to the people that are maintaining the library. Most of them are very, very active communities. And I think that that's also kind of helpful, because one of the things that I've also run into with like GitHub is there's a bunch of problems listed. And so, hey, I'm going to go look at solving this one problem. And I'm going to write this solution. And, you know, in the meantime, someone else was already on that problem who is active in the Slack or the Discord. And so now there's this, wait, who's this random person who just solved this problem? And should we give them precedence over this other active contributor who we do know incredibly well? Right. And so I think that's where you have to have that social couth and kind of that, you know, social etiquette does exist online in the internet and in GitHub repos.
Finding your space in there is important, and try not to be too aggressive on like, well, I fixed this terrible code, because good Lord, that could have been anybody who you're now insulting on how bad this code was or wasn't. So with your pull requests, you know, have, you know, you pull it out, you make several commits and you try and, you know, merge that back in. Or you submit the request to have it pulled in, make sure you have good commit messages, make sure you're well documenting your code. Because the last thing you want to do is, you know, write some really complex solution that, yeah, sure, maybe it solves the problem, but it's not documented. It's not that your pull or your commit messages are like fixed terrible code and whoever wrote this was garbage, right? You have that social cue to be able to know, okay, these are real people behind there. And how would you like it if someone was like, hey, I'd like to fix all your terrible code? Absolutely. I just, even if they did fix it, I'd be like, no thanks.
Yeah, I think one other thing to also just kind of tack into there, you know, if we're talking etiquette, if you're going to jump into a library that exists and try and solve a problem, don't just install another library. into this thing. Don't just download someone else's code and, you know, increase my dependency chain or something of that nature and expect me to accept your pull request.
Yeah, I think you guys just identified two great ways of getting shamed into non-existence on their project board there by 10,000 developers, for sure.
Yeah, and you know that shame, right, or that git blame, when it falls back on you, I think that's one of those things where if this is your first time trying to contribute, you know, and this is something that we've talked about with our students and maybe potentially previously on this podcast, but it's that concept of don't fall in love with your own code. If they deny your pull request and, you know, they give you some feedback, accept that feedback, you know, go and try and, you know, improve whatever, you know, that feedback is. If maybe you did find a valid solution, but, you know, you have three or four nested for loops in that solution, you know, that's not necessarily a good solution. We're not saying that you can't contribute. We're just saying that, hey, you know, here's some maybe better ways to improve upon that code, right?
To build on that, I would say falling in love with your code and such, they don't owe you anything. And so if they deny your request, or if they decide, you know, for whatever reason, to give you no feedback after denying your request, or maybe you submit a pull request and they don't even look at it, just understand that that happens. That person who's contributing to that library, maybe they're done. They're like, hey, you know what? I'm exhausted with this thing, and they haven't even touched it. Maybe even pay attention. Has this thing been touched in recently? It's been a 2 or 3 years since anyone's worked on it. Maybe it's dead to that owner. And so your pull request will go nowhere. Or if you look and there's like 100 pull requests, kind of start to weigh those options out when you're beginning to look at things to contribute to. Is it still active? Is there a ton of pull requests on there? Does the owner of the repository seem active?
Yeah, that's absolutely a great point. If you're working with something that's incredibly large, they have a stack of pull requests. They're likely to deny your pull request and not give you any reason. Like, look, dude, I get like 10,000 of these a month, and this is my pet project. I don't get paid for it. So that's absolutely something that can happen. And so that maybe comes back to that good starting point. If you're unsure of if you're going to be able to contribute something of value, go back to those examples, create those examples like Jake was saying. And I think you were saying that too, Mark. Start there, see what happens, get your feet wet, look under the hood, get more familiar with this thing. And that's ultimately what's going to bring you the most value.
So, and I think one of the other, you know, common pitfalls or, you know, those things that when you submit your pull request, don't sit on that GitHub page and keep hitting refresh and refresh and refresh, waiting, right? Like it may take, you know, 3, 4 days, weeks, months before those contributors or before the library maintainers have time to look at it, right? And if you want that successful fast track pass, you know, that's where you better be in their Discord. You better be in their Slack channel. Like I was saying, you know, there are ways to make sure that your pull request doesn't go unnoticed, but that's be an active contributor to the community.
I would also add that, you know, based on the first kind of what Daryl's saying and building on what you were saying is make sure that whatever you did is worth your time. And so if you are just trying to get contributions, right, and that's, I made that joke a little bit earlier about, oh, just go edit the readmes and clean them up. But sometimes, you know, if you're adding significant documentation, that's great. If you're fixing a couple spelling errors, I might deny your pull request and just go fix those myself. But on the flip side, the examples also make those great side projects, kind of what we talked about last week. Finding that thing, building it out, showing an example of, hey, this is how to use this tool. Here's a really good design use case for it. Great. Send that in. But keep it on your own repository history of, hey, here's a good project that I built.
Yeah, absolutely. And if nothing else, update the README to include a link to your example, right? Like, there you go. You know, problem solved. You don't necessarily have to get anything else approved than just a simple pull request to show off an example. So yeah, that's a really easy way to contribute to open source projects.
Yeah, and even to kind of shift it back to my first story there, we didn't use Git for a lot of that stuff or anything like that. We had some kinds of source control here and there, but sometimes it was fairly unorganized. But some of my greatest contributions or the values that I got back were just going on those message boards and sharing my ideas, my concepts, and maybe not even getting to code them out or see them come to fruition, but having that discussion and gaining that knowledge from it.
Yeah, sometimes just submitting a bug report,
you know, is in a lot of these, a lot of the GitHub projects now, you can submit a bug report, which will actually open a an issue, and then that issue gets tracked and it gets a number and it gets everything else, right? Like, and again, maybe not every single open source library has all of that fully set up, but many of them actually do. At least many of the ones that are probably worth contributing to that are still active have something of that nature in place.
It can give you, and this door could swing both ways, but it can give you a little bit of validation to say, oh, I do know what I'm doing, right? And this is a couple podcasts ago, but that imposter syndrome moment, and you're going to feel it terribly while you're probably submitting that pull request, and you're like, oh, God, I hope they accept this. I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's the appropriate solution to this problem and whatever. And when it does get accepted, that can be incredibly validating to say, hey, you know what? I actually do know what I'm doing, and I have contributed to open source projects. And so even taking that leap of faith initially to try to contribute, as soon as those get accepted, you're going to feel on cloud nine.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the whole purpose of open source is these are libraries, these are tools that we as developers have written to help each other, right? Help myself, help each other. And so the last thing I'm going to do is, you know, just shut down people that are trying to help me, right? Like, and I think a lot of that just comes with like code maturity and things of that nature, maturity in the career field is, you know, saying, hey, I don't have all the answers. I wrote this thing. Yeah, maybe I didn't do proper error handling here. Look at the other, you know, 3,000 features of this library that it does do correctly. Thank you. Thank you for catching the error. Like, I'm not going to probably slay you over something of that nature. So don't feel like you're going to be offensive or anything of that nature to, you know, those library maintainers.
Absolutely. That is the reason to go open source. You're looking for that help there. They're actively seeking that help, and they recognize, hey, I don't have the time to perform or get all of this done correctly 100% of the time.
All right. Well, I think that's going to wrap us up for this episode of the Dev Team. Thanks again for joining us. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dev Team. If you're interested in learning more about our team or possibly starting a career in software development, reach out to us at boisecodeworks.com. Follow us on Facebook and like and subscribe to this podcast to continue to receive the latest updates. Until then, from the Dev Team, remember, if you want clean code, wash your hands.